Our second case, United States v. Bradley, whenever the lawyers are ready. You can come on up, Ms. Hester. We won't start without you. Everybody seated. Don't worry.
We have a lot of things to
do. Do you know anything about the documents in that last case?
I still don't, no. Shall I go ahead?
Absolutely. Good morning.
May it please the court. Ann Hester representing Cecilia Bradley. The order requiring Bradley to pay restitution for William Byrd's injuries is illegal because it requires Bradley to pay restitution for injuries to a person who is not a victim under the applicable statutory definition, and Bradley's plea agreement also doesn't extend restitution liability to Byrd.
Well, can you look at the plea agreement language, because you would agree that a plea agreement can trump the statute? Right.
That's correct.
Okay. So if you look at the plea agreement language with me,
I have it right in front of me.
You have it with you? Yeah. Okay. To pay full restitution to all victims directly or indirectly harmed by Bradley's relevant conduct, including conduct pertaining to any dismissed counts. Why doesn't that cover what we have
here? Because William Byrd is not a victim under the statute. And
so, but that doesn't allow, remember we started out with the conception that the plea agreement can trump the statute. So you don't have to be a victim under the statute if you enter into a plea agreement saying you're going to do something, right?
If you enter into a plea agreement that changes the definition of victim. And there are, you have to look at the plea agreement as a whole, because the purpose of contract interpretation is to figure out what the party's intent is.
Is your point that victim there doesn't change the statutory definition of victim?
That's my point. And there are other parts of the plea agreement that indicate that the parties specifically, in this case, didn't have any intent to extend restitution liability to this particular person.
Then why does it include uncharged offenses, and what's the point of the plea agreement?
The point of the plea agreement was for Bradley to not have any liability for the acts that were committed against Byrd, actually. That was
what she was getting out of it. But
right.
Presumably the contract is for the benefit of both parties, and it seems to me your interpretation of the plea agreement renders all of that language, which is very expansive, a clearly goes beyond the statutory definition of victim, meaningless.
I don't think it clearly, first of all, this is a boilerplate restitution provision. I mean, you've seen this before. You saw it in Squirrel in 2009.
And has it ever been interpreted the way you would have it interpreted?
No, but it's never been interpreted the way they would have it interpreted either. This is a provision that the government puts in every case. It's in drug cases, and there aren't even any victims in drug cases.
Well, they don't have anything to worry about.
Right, but what I'm saying to the court is you have to look at the plea agreement as a whole, and there are three provisions that bear on this, actually, aside from the restitution provision. Take a look at paragraph 7, which is the only, that's on page 101 of the joint appendix. That is the only provision in this plea agreement that is tailored for this defendant and is not boilerplate. Okay? And in paragraph 7C, it provides, the parties agree that the victim sustained bodily injury pursuant to USSG 2A2.2B3A. Now, there are two parts of that sentence that indicate that the parties did not intend to extend restitution, in this case, to Byrd. First of all, it talks about a singular victim, not plural victims. But second, it demonstrates an agreement that Bradley's relevant conduct did not harm Byrd, because if that had been the case, The agreement would have provided that the victim sustained serious bodily injury, which is injury requiring hospitalization, because Byrd was stabbed and he did require hospitalization, while Crow, which is the person that Bradley actually assaulted, did not require hospitalization. She was released.
The difficulty that I have with that argument is that it appears to be taking language that is quite clear on its face and introducing ambiguity.
Well, I don't think that the language is quite clear on its face, and I'll explain to the court why.
We're now going back to the language about that I wrote read to you. Is that right?
Right. Back to paragraph 8A. This actually is a confusing paragraph because it doesn't define the term victims in any way other than under the MVRA or the VWPA. And actually, in Barefoot, that's a term of art. And in Barefoot, the court said that leaving a term of art undefined is sufficient to require application of the statutory definition. But four additional factors indicate that the parties actually did understand that victim had the statutory definition in this paragraph. First, that failure to define victims indicates an intent to refer to the statutory meaning of that term.
I thought the MVRA also recognized that a court could order restitution to a person other than the victim of the offense, as the statute provides.
Certainly. But 20 years ago, in the Blake case, this court explained exactly how that is to be done. In Blake...
Exclusively?
Not necessarily exclusively.
That was sort of my reading of that language as well. And that was... I didn't view that as being... What the MVRA appears to do is to just recognize that a court can order restitution to be paid to victims other than the statutory victims, depending on if the plea agreement so provides. It doesn't delimit, or at least I did not read it as a delimiting language.
Mm-hmm. But at the same time, that case is 20 years old. So the parties, I mean, that is part of what the parties have in their understanding when they're drafting this plea agreement about how that is to be done.
But again, you're going beyond. You tell me that the plea agreement language is ambiguous. And to do so, you go to an interpretation of a 20-year-old precedent that doesn't exactly say anything directly on point. It simply refers back to the statute, which allows a plea agreement to do exactly what this agreement does, as I understand it. Just tell me where my reasoning is falling down. It seems to me that your argument, and I grasp it, but it seems to me it introduces a level of complexity into a scenario that is about as straightforward as I usually see. And maybe that's why I find it so appealing.
Okay, well, but actually this paragraph, as you're reading it, is not as clear-cut as you would have it, because there is another statutory term in there, which is offense. And if you'll look at it, the paragraph specifically removes offense from the definition, the statutory definition. So reading that paragraph, a person reading it would reasonably think, if we were removing victim from that definition, we would also say that the term victim also is not as defined in the statute, but it doesn't do that, which introduces an ambiguity.
Doesn't the factual basis also identify Byrd as victim one?
The factual basis does identify him as victim one, but the purpose of that was to conceal his identity. And again, I would point the court to, let's look at paragraph 14 of the plea agreement, which specifically talks about the purpose of the factual basis. That paragraph explains exactly what the factual basis is to be used for. And it says that the factual basis can be used by the court and the probation office to determine the applicable advisory guideline range or the appropriate sentence under 3553A. It says nothing about restitution. So, first of all, that's not part of the factual basis is not part of the plea agreement. It's simply attached. And second of all, the parties had an understanding that the purpose of that factual basis was not to be relevant to the district court's determination of restitution.
But don't we have to factor that in if we accept your premise that victim is ambiguous? there are arguments, if we do go that route, it would seem to me that there are arguments that cut both ways, which is...
But I think that if there are arguments that cut both ways, it's ambiguous. The factual basis does nothing to remove ambiguity, because while it describes him as victim one, it also says that Moses Reed was the person who admitted to stabbing the male victim, and also it says that Cecilia Bradley specifically denies having assaulted victim one.
Okay, just one more question, and I'll leave you alone.
And then I'm going to bother you.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's on.
I'm ready.
You always are.
Thank you.
How would a plea agreement, here we have a situation in which Bradley took on one victim, and so that victim was unable to come to the assistance of another victim. If we accept your interpretation, how does a plea agreement do what I thought, what it seems to me that this plea agreement is obviously trying to do?
It would be very easy, actually, just by substituting the word individuals for the word victim in that paragraph. And that's what they told the government to do, and they haven't done. Or it could specifically say that she's agreeing. I mean, to make it abundantly clear for the defendant who's signing the plea agreement, why not just say she is responsible for restitution to this particular individual?
I'm sure the government is taking notes.
I'm sure they are.
How about say victims, which include, in this case, the two, it includes those and maybe others.
Right. I mean, just to be clear.
When I said I was going to bother you, you didn't think I was going to bother you this way, did you?
Yeah, but here's appreciate that kind of bother.
Here's the point. This is what we're put at doing. We're put at, who? You've already told us, whose agreement is this? For most of this language, did you come up with the language?
Absolutely not.
The government does, don't they?
I mean, in fact, you
can
look at...
Isn't that correct?
Yes.
Correct.
And you can look at this one and see they had to mark out some of the boilerplate.
I didn't ask you that. So the government does it.
Yes.
And then we find ourselves, this is what I don't like. I don't like that we have a U.S. attorney or assistant U.S. attorney that writes an agreement, they control it, and they don't put in it what they later come up, and we spend a lot of our time arguing, gosh, how do we get there? What do we do in that case? Why is this sort of a simple formula? And I thought there was this formula. If you don't say and it's not clear, you government, you write it, you lose. Isn't that the basic rule?
That is the basic rule.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so if that were the clear basic rule, it would be to assistant U.S. attorneys and U.S. attorneys, put in it exactly what you want to do. If you want to use this document to punish somebody, make it crystal clear. By the way, let me also add, I do believe that many times defense lawyers see little problems, and they don't always say we better correct that, government. But I'm not sure, quite frankly, that's the burden put on a defense attorney. Do you agree with me?
That is not under this court's precedent. If there is an ambiguity, it's interpreted.
I'm talking about even if the defense attorney sees it at the time of the agreement, they sometimes maybe see a little catch in the agreement, and they maybe don't call it to the attention of the government.
And he's certainly not suggesting you would ever do this.
Well, and I can't even speak to that because I don't do cases in trial court, so I don't know the answer to that. I haven't quizzed my
just let me say, I've seen it.
Okay.
Both as a district judge and a appeals judge. But I do think the point is, and I think the law is clear, if the government wants to push or hold somebody responsible, liable, make it clear. And if it's not clear, you lose. It's not the end of the world. You just lose on this. And you think if you fall out, if victim isn't clear, what part did you say was specifically added to this plea agreement?
That's paragraph 7, which is the paragraph
about... Just 7.
Right.
Just 7. And in that, what was added to this says victim.
Correct.
No S. Victim.
Correct.
And your argument is it's boilerplate, which I think you said actually in your argument. But here, we made one difference to be sure it reflected what the agreement was. And we talk about victim. And you also say about severe bodily injury.
Correct.
So then you think you fall to a proximate causation argument. As to whether or not Byrd is a victim.
He's not a victim under the statute. because he's not a victim of her offense of conviction.
What about the directly or indirectly language? Is he indirectly a victim because had Byrd not been prevented, had someone been able to come to Byrd's assistance, presumably Byrd would have not been injured. I think, isn't that part of the argument?
That's part of the argument that the government made in the district court. I don't think that the court actually adopted that particular argument.
Can they adopt it on the facts and record in this case?
And that's what I was about to say. I think the court should look closely at the factual basis.
Can they?
No.
Why is that so? That's why I was going to the proximate causation.
Because there were also three other people, first of all, with the victim, in addition to this woman that our client assaulted. She wasn't the only person there, but the other thing is that there's no indication in the factual basis of when the assault on her occurred in relation to the assault
on her.
What?
The timing.
It was all of a piece. It wasn't elongated as we have seen in other cases. It was one brawl.
We can't tell from the factual basis. It really doesn't reveal that. We know that they showed up on the scene, but we don't know what the elapsed time is because it doesn't say.
But it's one brawl. I mean, we may not know that it was 10, you know, we may not be able to delimit it, but we do know it's unlike the case where there was an accessory after the fact. Do you remember the one I'm thinking about?
You're talking about the squirrel cake.
Yeah.
Squirrel.
Yeah. It was
two fights that happened within a period of time, or two assaults that happened. We don't know other than our client was involved with Crow.
But then they get in the car and drive. They drove up
they
together.
They did leave together.
And then
yes.
They left together.
Yes.
They were all together
at the same time. But time-wise, in relation to each other, we don't know.
You're saying the record doesn't, I think your argument is, the record doesn't reflect whether or not her assault on, Crow, on this record, it could have come after Byrd was stabbed.
That's correct.
And the record doesn't make that distinction.
No.
Even if it took 2 minutes, 30 seconds, this record does not support the fact, does not support a finding that she was the proximate causation of the stabbing. Because what she did, according to the court, is she, I think, hit somebody with a bat or something. And she hit somebody. The theory is it kept that person from going to Byrd's defense to prevent the stabbing. But had the stabbing occurred prior to the bat swing, it wouldn't matter.
Right, correct? And we just don't know.
We do know that proximate is not indirect. Proximate is an ensuing chain, but indirect isn't. I mean, indirect doesn't require one to necessarily follow the other.
That's true, but I think you have to go back to that paragraph because he has to be a victim in the first place before it matters whether it's direct or indirect.
Okay.
With regard to that paragraph, the paragraph defines dismissed counts or uncharged conduct as defined by a section, and then it also defines, regardless of whether such conduct constitutes an offense, and then it looks to another statutory section. So the fact that it didn't use the provisions that you say define victim, it didn't reference them.
Right.
Does that lead us to an inference that it is not a term that is defined by those statutory provisions?
No, it leads to the opposite inference under the Barefoot case. In Barefoot, the term of art.
I understand, but we're dealing with this. Did the Barefoot case also involve a provision in the plea agreement that defined other terms in the way that this one does?
I don't remember
that it did.
I don't know the answer to that question, but I do know that both with
seems to me that makes it a little different here if it didn't.
Well, I don't think that it does because I think that criminal defense lawyers and prosecutors have a common understanding of what the term victim means in the context of restitution, and that's
they probably have a common understanding
definition
of what dismissed counts or uncharged conduct is too, but that's defined,
right?
And also offense. In fact, I think they'd have a stronger understanding of what those things are, since they're all key to any criminal case, right?
Well, my point is that this paragraph specifically refers to the statutory term and broadens it. If the parties had intended to do that with the term victims, they would have done the same thing. But they didn't.
So it's hard to come up with a victim is a pretty basic term. It's hard to come. I'm trying to think of another. You could use individuals, but I'm not sure one sees victim. That's a pretty ubiquitous term that has a meaning. Especially
could it be somebody back at the house who's lost money putting their friend in the hospital. That would be a person.
But it does have it is a term of art in the context of restitution, and it has a particular meaning that parties in the criminal context would understand to be the statutory meaning.
And as I understand your argument, you say that these other provisions these other terms that are defined, what citing to the statutory or guidelines provision did was narrow them. But that's not necessarily true. It could be broadening what we ordinarily think of as dismissed counts or uncharged conduct.
It definitely offenses. Broadened the definition of offense. But my point is, it does that specifically by referring to the statute. But my point is, if they had intended to
I
do that.
I understand what you're saying. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Mr. Enright? So I think you probably were sitting here and taking all in what Judge Shedd said.
I was.
So what do you have to say in response to that?
Well, Your Honor, I guess there's two things I want to say. The first is, I first should introduce myself, Anthony Enright for the United States, may it please the Court. I do think the simplest answer to this question is to look at the plain language of the agreement, which is bird injuries result or the restitution related to injuries to Byrd was appropriate because Byrd was a victim directly or indirectly harmed by the defendant's relevant conduct. But even if this court were to accept the defendant's position that victim means the term victim as it's defined in the act, the result is the same. Byrd is a victim. And I think the defense is conflating two parts of the statute. The statute defines victim specifically. The term victim means a person directly and proximately harmed as a result of the commission of an offense for which restitution may be ordered. The definition is very broad. It does not limit victims to victims injured by the offense of conviction. Another provision, another component of the statute imposes that limitation by default.
Although
subsection 1.
The provision you just read to us did use the term that Judge Shedd used, proximately caused, which is
yes.
Not, I mean, I think indirectly is broader in that there is not the same temporal connectivity of result, it's not cause result.
That's correct, Your Honor. I think all we need to determine to figure out whether Byrd is a victim is to determine whether he was injured proximately by the assault on Byrd. In other words, the assault by Moses Reed on Byrd.
Do we know that it's proximate?
Yes, because Moses Reed stabbed him, or one of the folks there stabbed him.
The argument is that we don't know what happened first.
I think that's a slightly different question. I think that question is whether Moses Reed's assault on Byrd is relevant conduct to the defendant. And that question is a little bit different from whether Byrd qualifies as a victim.
But you start about reading proximately harm. That's what you led with, proximately.
Yes, Your Honor. He needs to have been proximately harmed by his assault, by the assault on Byrd. The assault on Byrd by Moses Reed and the other Reeds
is an offense. I see what you're saying. It is an offense. Okay.
Correct. So he is a victim because that is an offense. It is not the offense of conviction. And if we were just talking about the statute, I don't believe that Ms. Bradley would be responsible for that. But the plea agreement extends her restitution liability to acts that are proximately caused by acts and omissions of others if they are relevant conduct. And I think that was what Judge Shedd was getting at, because it's only relevant conduct if it's during the same, if it's reasonably foreseeable in furtherance of a jointly undertaken activity and is during the commission of the offense of conviction or in preparation for it or as part of an attempt to evade detection or apprehension. But I think the district court could reasonably have inferred that everything that occurred from the time they got out of the SUV with weapons during this brawl and the time they got back into the SUV with those weapons was during the commission of the offense, and if not during the commission of the offense itself.
If you had put their names in this plea agreement, the government had, would we be having an argument?
I don't think we would, but we might well be having some other argument.
We wouldn't be having this one, would we?
Perhaps not, though.
Perhaps not.
If he owed restitution to Byrd, then we would probably be having an argument over whether this is restitution to Byrd because it's technically payable to, I believe, the hospital. So it would be something else.
But wouldn't be a question of whether or not she was responsible in the first, second, third part for injuries for Byrd, would we?
I don't think so, Your Honor, but I think it's perfectly clear because we use the term victims and however defined.
Oh, I know how perfectly clear it is. You've got a good lawyer arguing on one side, and we're asking you questions about it.
Absolutely.
You may win, but that's a lot of court time.
That's true. I don't. I somehow suspect we've still seen an appeal if we'd phrased it differently, because that's what the defense job is.
Let me ask you this: you're arguing like a good lawyer.
I appreciate
you. You think your case would be stronger if it said you agree to pay restitution to the victims here, which victims include Mr. Byrd and others? You think your case would be stronger?
I think we'd run into the problem I just mentioned, which is the defense counsel would be arguing that Byrd's not actually the victim because he got his treatment.
The hospital's
the victim.
I see what you mean.
So we'd run into another problem there. Victims, I mean, the defense counsel and Judge Duncan both make the point. Victim is a term that we're familiar with. And we might quibble about whether it's a statutory term.
Victim out. And say you agree to pay restitution for the injuries to Crow and Byrd. What about that? Wouldn't you have a stronger case?
I suppose, Your Honor, but there's a question of which injuries. Injuries caused by what? Injuries that they suffered as a result of...
We still might have that argument right now.
Certainly.
But it would knock out the question of whether or not whatever that means covers Byrd. I don't know that it helps you to continue arguing on this point. Maybe I'm missing something. But for you to say it wouldn't help...
Your Honor,
it would not help you as to whether or not Byrd is covered to have Byrd listed as somebody who is covered by the agreement.
It is a fair point. We could have phrased it differently, and we perhaps could have phrased it in a way that avoided the specific argument here. I do believe we phrased it in a way that is clear. I certainly recognize the court might disagree with me, but
I suggest you go back and talk to the other lawyers and suggest maybe they put names in agreement.
I will certainly do that, Your Honor. What does happen, though, is ordinarily we'll have language like this, and then there's a sentencing process at which the victims are determined. Sometimes the court disagrees with us about who is a victim and who ought to receive restitution, and there's a statutory requirement also.
Argue that out in front of them and get most of that straight. You think a district court would say you don't owe money to Byrd, although you agreed in the agreement to pay for Byrd's? As part of your plea agreement, you think they would say you don't owe Byrd?
No, Your Honor, I'm not saying that.
Yeah.
It wouldn't have anticipated the specific dispute.
Can I ask you to go back? Because
certainly,
I think my colleagues understand your argument, but I'm not positive I do. So you say, okay, no matter whether you look at the definition of victim, as we would ordinarily think of victim, or the statutory definition of victim, you win. And what language in the statute are you, and what statute and what language are you relying on?
It's the Mandatory Victims Restitution Act, 18 U.S.C. 3663A, subsection A2.
Right.
For the purposes of this section, the term victim means a person directly and proximately harmed as a result of the commission of an offense for which restitution.
So your argument, I think, and maybe this is what Judge Motz is going, I take your argument to be that Byrd is, Crow, Byrd is a victim under the statute because he was harmed by
an assault.
An offense, an offense.
Correct.
And the plea agreement makes Bradley liable for harm to him caused by her
relevant
conduct.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. So the fact that, I mean, Byrd is a victim of an offense, so they're, I think I, yes.
Yes, Your Honor.
I understand your argument.
I understand the argument now, and I think that what you say, what you've said is, yes, Judge Shedd might be right that we should have written or could have written or might have written or there is a possible way to write this better, but that this does it even if you accept the defendant's arguments.
That's correct, Your Honor. I think even if you accept the defendant's arguments, Byrd is a victim, and Byrd is a victim of the defendant's relevant conduct, and therefore restitution is authorized under the statute because it's included in the plea agreement. I do want to speak... I want to mention the statute, the limitation the defendant refers to, victims being of only of the defendant's offensive conviction. That is in the statute. It's just in a different part from the definition of victim. It's in subsection A1, which says when sentencing...
So if they're looking at the statutory definition of victim, they take that portion, that statutory definition, not this other provision, because the plea agreement certainly trumps the
yes.
other statutory provision.
Yes. By default, it's only the offense of conviction.
Okay.
But
and am I to understand that Section 8 of the plea agreement that we're discussing here, 8A, is boilerplate?
I don't know if I'd use the term boilerplate. It is language that we use fairly regularly.
Do you tinker with it upon occasion?
I think it's the kind of thing that if the defendant asked us to tinker with, we would consider and perhaps bring to a supervisor. I don't know how often that occurs or
well,
not.
Well, so that's boilerplate.
Perhaps, Your Honor. I mean, it's a term of art that's sometimes used pejoratively, so I prefer to use a different term, like
is this the
ordinary.
Usual thing that's in a plea agreement?
It is. It's pretty common.
Okay. What about the language in 7?
I don't know. I do believe this, among some other parts of the plea agreement, for example, identifying the specific counts in the bill of the indictment, the statutory maximum, and the case name, those are things that were adjusted for this. These are the specific offense characteristics that they agreed to. I do think these were tailored, but honestly, that's just based on reading it now.
You weren't the lawyer that handled this?
That's true.
And you didn't discuss it with the lawyer that did?
Well, the lawyer that handled it, Your Honor, I think is actually was out of our office before I got there. But the I have only considered the language in paragraph 7 when I heard defense counsel mentioning it a few moments ago. But I do believe it is tailored to this offense.
So this argument you don't believe is made in the defense counsel's brief?
Pardon me?
You don't think that the argument that defense counsel made was made in the defense counsel's brief?
Well, I think the general argument was. I just didn't look. I'm just telling you the truth, Your Honor. I hadn't looked at paragraph 7 and tried to figure out its origins or relevance to this case until just a few moments ago, and it may be my own failing for doing that.
She said it was tailor-made for this case. If we accept that.
I have no reason to believe that's not true.
If we accept that, then what do we do with that C language? It says victim sustained bodily injury. It doesn't sound like victims, and it doesn't sound like serious bodily injury. What are we to do with the specific bargain for provision that is not boilerplate?
I don't think it's particularly relevant, Your Honor, because the question of the provision that's governing here, that's in dispute here, is what is the meaning that language reasonably permits?
Well,
and I think that's pretty straightforward.
Is that language? Well, first of all, not that straightforward. She made a reasonable argument, as I understood her argument, to be wrong, that she specifically bargained for this language. And that language reflects a specific bargain for thing that she wanted or was willing to agree to. Why? And that seems to me different. You're making some theory on what 8A is, and I do understand your argument. We just ignore the bargain for 7C. We just don't count that?
Well, I don't think you need to not count it. There are different provisions that were negotiated, I suppose, differently.
You don't see them as inconsistent.
I don't see them as inconsistent, Your Honor. One is a specific offense characteristic under the guidelines, and I don't know how much thought was put into negotiating, whether it would be a bodily injury or a serious bodily injury. I think when...
Of course, what you're saying about that, we shouldn't even pay any attention to that, because you have no idea what happened.
Well, that's not the... I think it's not necessarily relevant, not because I don't know. That's my fault, and if the court wants to know about it and I don't know, that's my problem, not the court's.
But your take on what...
The reason...
guessing that sustained bodily injury versus substantial doesn't mean anything. You're just guessing at that. You have no idea.
Well, I can read what it says. I just don't know the history behind it, how it got into that language.
Is it your contention that this 7 only goes to conduct that the defendant herself engaged in?
I think a lot of it is probably to avoid disputes about that kind of thing. So
is the answer to that yes? We have a hard time getting to yes and no.
I do apologize for that, Your Honor. I suppose I don't know the answer. I would want to read that guideline, 2A2.2B3A, before I'd answer that. And
is your contention that it's just sort of a typographical error or something that doesn't say victims and sustain substantial bodily injury, or is it your argument to us that all this does is talk about what she directly committed?
It sounds reasonable that it only talks about what she directly admitted, or there may have been an agreement that, for purposes of this, we would recommend that the court only find her to be a victim, or the definition of victim could be different, or the significance of victim could be different in this provision than it is in the Mandatory Victims Restitution Act. I guess my answer is I don't really know.
Why?
And I do apologize for that, Your Honor. It is something I should have noticed before a few minutes ago, but it is not something that I did.
It does seem to me that there's something to be made of the fact that now I'm confusing them. Bird was.
You're in good company with me.
Bird was identified as victim one in the plea agreement. Who was?
I think Bird was victim one, but I can double check. I think. Hopefully, I have that here.
I am looking through the appellant's brief for this argument. And I'm not finding. Well, okay, so I'm only.
Victim one was Bird.
Huh?
Victim one was Bird in the factual basis. I do not recall seeing an argument about subsection 7C in the brief. I may have missed it.
Yeah, I
personally did not catch it until just 5 minutes ago.
Okay, I'm not seeing it.
And maybe I'm not doing my job here for Your Honors, and I apologize for that. I do think that 8A stands on its own.
That's the only provision of the plea agreement that I see.
Well, it probably won't help anybody, but I read it before I got in here, and I highlighted 7C.
Okay.
I don't know if that came from her saying specifically, or if I just read it to figure out what was going on. I'm not surprised by that argument, but maybe, I don't know why, maybe, I mean, I do, I mean.
Well, we can find out where it is in the brief momentarily. So do you have anything else to say to us?
I don't think so, Your Honor. If it has no further questions, I will yield the balance of my time to the district, to you guys, and I will ask that to this court, and I will ask that you affirm the restitution order of the district court.
Thank you very much.
That's a good way.
Sure. Okay, Ms. Hester, do you make this argument in your brief?
That argument is not in the brief, Your Honor. It's an additional point in support of the argument that I did make, and unfortunately, you know, it happens every time I get ready for oral argument. I I reread and saw that point, and that is why I'm bringing it up before the court, because I felt it was incumbent to bring it to the court's attention.
Do you know, were you a party to the negotiation of this plea agreement?
I was not, but I have talked to the trial attorney about it, and what she said to me was, we had no idea we would get tagged for restitution for this. The whole point of the plea agreement was to eliminate Cecilia Bradley's responsibility for this assault on Byrd, which was committed by another person,
that's what Seven does.
Right.
That's only for the findings of fact with respect to the conduct, her conduct, right?
That's correct, but of course that encompasses relevant conduct. It just wasn't within the contemplation of the parties at the time that that she would be ordered to pay restitution for Byrd. For one thing,
getting your hearsay testimony about
right.
what she said. Did she also say that she always thought that 8A was the victims there was defined by these statutory terms, even though it doesn't say that?
I think it didn't occur to her that it would mean anything else.
Well, she didn't say that.
She didn't say that. That's my assumption. I mean, what I do know is that it never occurred to her that she would get tagged for restitution to this other person. And unfortunately, the way that it works in district court is you don't see the request for restitution until after you've pleaded guilty, and in this case, even after the first PSR is filed. So unless it's in the plea agreement, you don't even know that that's going to be requested.
So did you all file a response to that?
Yes.
And did the response make the argument about Section 7?
No. I would like to talk about the government's interpretation of the term victim.
Just stop for a second. So when did you kind of surprise? I saw that. You were making some argument what she was responsible for. I read the plea agreement to try to figure it out, and I stopped on that point. But when did you find that point? I stopped on it. You talked about the plea agreement. She didn't have to pay. You make specific things about NVRA and other
right.
things like that.
You came upon it when you were preparing for oral argument.
Right. I mean, I wrote. I honestly don't know what I was thinking a year ago when I wrote these briefs. I mean, it's been a whole year. So you know, when I prepare for oral argument, I start over again, basically. And
well, which is I always tell lawyers is a good thing to do. But
right.
often you have to. Please, I mean, you know, we tag you if you haven't made the argument in the brief. So.
I understand that, but I think that it's reasonably within the scope of the argument that we did make. You know, because I did argue that you have to interpret the plea agreement as a whole, and that it's the point of interpreting the plea agreement is
trying to wonder, maybe I read more than I should have, but you want to make some other point.
Well, I did want to make the point that I think the government's interpretation of the definition of victim under the statute is incorrect, because the statutory definition of victim also talks about the offense, and it talks about the defendant's conduct specifically underlying the offense. And in fact, in the Blake case, this court specifically said that the term victim includes that limitation, the offense of conviction. So I think that that's contrary to the established precedent of this court to say that the definition of victim under the statute isn't limited to the offense of conviction. It is limited to the offense of conviction.
Well, it's not limited to, it's not even limited to charged conduct.
But the statutory,
in the plea agreement.
Well, in the plea agreement, but he's trying to say that the statutory definition of victim isn't limited to the victim of the offense, and that is wrong. Under Blake, that is wrong.
Okay.
He's trying to say that in paragraph A1, the victim of the offense is something different than the definition of the victim. But if you go down to the definition of the term victim again, it limits it to the victim of the offense that the defendant has been convicted
unoffense,
of.
Unoffense, I thought he said.
Unoffense, but you have to keep
reading. But he did make the point that in the statute, that the provision that he was looking at, it said X, and you had to go further to another provision for it to say what you said. Is that not right?
That's what he says.
I know, and we're going
right.
to have the statute in front of us. So, you know, go to it. But making an argument that's inconsistent with the statute is, you know, we eventually will have it all together.
Right.
So is he incorrect in saying that the provision that he's relying on says unoffense and that you have to go further down to get the language that you wish?
It says an offense for which restitution may be ordered. And then there's additional language that makes that talks about conspiracy, scheme, conspiracy, whatever, and it specifically talks about the defendant's offense of conviction. And in Blake, this court said that it's limited, that the definition of victim includes victim of the offense. So I really think that he is arguing contrary to this court's precedent.
Not necessarily contrary to the statute.
But also contrary to the statute. It is contrary to the statute as well.
I think we understand that. We understand. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
We will come down and greet the lawyers and then go directly to our next case. Thank you.